BoardGameMasters.com is a great game mastering blog if you're looking for advice. The guys from Gnome Stew founded a publishing company called Engine Publishing. So I'm now a published author. My first book is Eureka, 501 Plus to Inspire Game Masters. I'm a co-author, actually. And that is available at Gen Con as well. End of shameless plugs. So,
congratulations.
Improvising, GM's backup plan. As you probably read in the description for this seminar, I give this seminar every year. And every year I make it a point to start off by saying, I planned absolutely nothing for this seminar. Why? Because if I can improvise speaking to all of you can run a game at the drop of a hat. It's not that hard. So, I may cover some things I talked about in the seminar in previous years, but thinking about what I would say, not preparing, just thinking about it, I came to the conclusion I'm really going to try to avoid that as much as I can and try to give you more practical advice for some particularly tough systems. So, let me go over some things that I have spoken about in previous years. One, improvising is not creating things out of nothing. It's not pulling things out of thin air. Improvising is actually learning a set of skills that allow you to organize content that you already have into a game. Okay? Big difference. Nobody sits down at a table, decides to run it, decides to be a GM, and does it without a single clue as to what the game system does, as to what the players want, as to what the genre should be, all right? We all have all the information we need just from everyday existence to run a game, okay? The problem is that most people never take the time to develop the skills required to tap into that creativity. That's really within all of us. And so when we see someone who does it spontaneously, and we're used to the process of, oh yeah, I sit down and I prep and I spend 4 hours to design an encounter, and this guy comes and he does it, and he just, you know, wings it, and people love his games, and I hate him for it. Yeah. The truth is, the only difference is that one guy hasn't taken the time to learn a different set of skills. How come someone who can, you know, put so much detail into, and so much effort into their prep work can't run a quick encounter off the top of their head? Well, they can't. They're just afraid to. You know, it's kind of that security blanket. You know, if I do my prep work, the game will be good. All the prep work in the world won't save you from Danny. Danny is a game player that is at my local game shop, and he can fuck up the best of them. And if anyone has a problem with my language, please let me know now, and I'll, you know, go back to a nice, normal tone. Otherwise, I'm going to be really fucking bold. All right. You can do all the prep work, and this is the kind of guy who just screws up your games. Because that's what he gets kicks out of. You know? You guys go to visit the king. Okay. I stab him. How do you handle that? Right. This is a great time, no matter how much prep you've done, to improvise. Because you probably didn't plan for Danny the Psycho to show up and shank the king. And the guys who prep, who spend all that time prepping, still do this. They just don't realize that you can do it for the full session. Right. So how would we handle that situation? We react by thinking immediately, what if? And you run through these scenarios in your head. You know, that's what human beings are great at. That's what our brains actually evolved to do. What if scenarios? We take things, we categorize them, we compare them, and then we make decisions based on our comparisons. So you really look at that and go, okay, he's going to go stab the king. So what if that were to happen? Well, probably wouldn't even get close to the king before the royal guard jumped on him. I'll have that happen. You just like, all right, Danny, you try, dude, but the royal guard jumps on you. Yeah. And not only that, but they hack you a bit with swords. Yeah. Thank you for playing. Here's a blank character sheet. Get back to me when you're done with that. So, you know, you already know how to improvise. You just don't know how to stretch out those improvisational skills to cover a full event. Right? Now, I practice what I preach. Not only do I improvise this seminar, but for last year, I ran 4 fudge games because it's a very easy system that allows me to improvise quickly for the con. It was, here's a chart, It's got a type of monster, it's got a type of genre, it's got a type of, you know, setting. You roll the dice, I run that game. We had bunnies, as in the characters were bunnies, fighting zombie hamsters. You can't prep for that. This year, it's the same thing, because I'm pushing the book. It's, okay, you know what? Here's the copy of the book. Flip through it. One of those 501 plots, and I'll admit, I haven't read them all. You know, I just wrote, you know, a ninth of them. Whatever plot you end up with is the game I'm running. So I have no idea if I'm running a sci-fi, a horror game, a fantasy game. I don't know if we're fighting zombies or robots, whatever. But I get the plot. I usually only read the first paragraph because it's Gen Con. You gotta go, because it's only 4 hours. And I run the game. And it's a lot of fun. Why? Because I observe the players. Rule number one, you have to observe your players. How many people play poker? All right. What are you watching when you see the other players? I just dealt you your cards. All right, I'm the dealer. Person next to you is another opponent, right? What are you doing while I'm dealing him his cards?
Watching his reaction.
Why are you watching his reaction?
See what he's got. I guess what he's got.
But you're guessing at what he's got. And a good poker player guesses very well. You as a GM have to learn how to guess what the player wants. Because the first thing a player will always tell you is, no, that's fine. They're full of it. It's not fine. You can literally see someone, you know, their character gets hit, they take a lot of damage, like, well, you know, I'm sorry, you know, that's the rule. No, it's fine. Really? Wow, I hate to see you happy. You know, so you have to observe the players. And as you observe the players, you have to catch on to what's the little bits of the game that they enjoy. Okay? If they're big into role-playing, every time there's a chance for discussion, every time there's a chance for dialogue, and especially when there's a chance for them to have a monologue, those players will, you know, they'll stand a little bit more, they'll sit a little bit more erect. You know, they're getting into that prone position of, they're going to expand their chest. I mean, seriously, this is just body language. Guys, if you can find two seats together, they're up here. They'll do things like that. These are body language cues letting you know that they're ready to take the stage. Okay? They're going to try to make eye contact with you. You've got to look for stuff like that. If they're heavy into the mechanics, right? If they're heavy into combat and stuff like that, they're going to give you little subtle cues like they keep on reaching for their dice. Why are they doing that? Because they want to roll. That's your cue as a GM to get into a combat scene, to have something happen. Now, the problem is that, for some reason, people tend to think that you have to have a prepared plot, or you have to have a prepared environment, you have to have a detailed setting. How many of you live in a cave in the middle of nowhere? The day someone answers that question with, I do, I'm going to be impressed. All of you live in a community, right? And if you have to improvise a community in your game, you can just base it on your hometown, okay? And I'm serious, base it on your hometown. The players don't want to tour every little nook and cranny of the game world. They just want to go to the parts that either get them stuff, get them into fights, or get them into trouble, okay? And you know where these parts are in your own hometown. You all know where there's one bar that, you know, you don't want to go there. The guys get a little rough and rowdy and the cops are there a lot. That's the place that can get them into trouble. Right? Throw that into your game. If it's a biker bar in your town, nothing against bikers. I've just been to a lot of biker bars. You know? If it's a biker bar in your town, when you're running your game, if it's D&D, that's where the rough and rowdy races get together. Like the orcs hang out there and drink a lot. And the dwarves show up. And they're rivals. And the dwarves drink a lot. And about halfway through the drinking, the fighting starts. You know? You can have that in your town. You can improvise that easily. The place that gets them stuck. There's a Walmart, a Kmart, a Target. There's a shop in your community. You can base your imaginary role-playing town on Walmart. You know? Just make it smaller and don't have a breeder. But you have an idea of what's going to be there.
Low prices.
Now I got to run a D&D game with that.
This longsword's only six silver. What a bargain. Yeah.
We'll open up the Costco. You can have 12 swords.
And we're playing with the encumbrance rules tonight.
Let's build an Albury.
But you can base what you're going to have in the game world on Walmart. Okay, it's simple. When the player shows up asking for the +5 Vorpal sword, if Walmart don't carry it, your game store don't carry it. You know, it's going to be mundane everyday items. And then you can have, you know, you got the place that they can get stuff, you have the place that can get them in trouble, all right, and the place that can get them into a fight, all right. And that, you probably don't have a, you probably have a place where you can pick a fight in your hometown. But there's really, you know, no combat zone that I know of in the United States. And there, all you have to do is understand why the players want to get into a fight. Okay? Or I should say, why the characters want to get into a fight. You have to know the motivation. And the motivation comes from the character concept. If a guy's playing a paladin of Vela, right? Or he's playing Luke Skywalker in the Star Wars game. Or he's playing a smurf in some really bad, crappy smurf game. You cannot tell me there's a good smurf game. Right? I will not believe that. But
I'll make one.
You do that. And watch it next week's going on fucking Anaport. But whatever the game is, they have a character concept, and that character concept is based on a motivation. You know, the paladin wants to be the hero, and they want to champion peasants. Great. You need them to get into a fight? All you have to do is throw some peasants near the bar where the orcs are hanging out and have their village destroyed. The paladin's going to be like, ooh, we got to go investigate that. You know? You got a thief who likes to steal stuff? All you have to do is at the bar, again, dwarves start talking about how there's a dungeon, and you know, there's a lot of treasure, but it's really risky. But there's a lot of treasure. That guy's going to be motivated. So look at the characters that they're playing, and take a moment, if you're going to improvise, and say, you know, that's a great character. Why don't you tell me a little bit about him? Every gamer will tell you pages upon pages about their characters. You don't have to worry about not getting enough info from them, right? Just say, tell me a little bit about your character, and they're going to give you the first few sentences, the main motivation. Take a little bit of note. Thank that for when you start running the game. Now, something I touched on last year. Movies. We all have our favorites. We all have those movies that, you know, we remember scene for scene. You have to run a game. Okay? You have nothing prepared. You have no storyline. You don't know what to do. Take your favorite movie from another genre than the game you're running and reskin it. You're going to run a pulp adventure. Okay? Indiana Jones type adventure. You have nothing prepared. You're going to base it on, you know, someone named their favorite film.
The Smurfs movie.
There's a special level of hell.
Ben-Hur.
What's that?
Ben-Hur.
Ben-Hur. Great. Okay. You're going to base the game on Ben-Hur. Right? So, you can set it up that the player characters, they're Indiana Jones, right? They're going to go to a distant land, just like in Ben-Hur, they go to Rome, right? And you can have it that they get kidnapped, right? Or not so much they get kidnapped, they get surrounded by a large army. It's Indiana Jones, right? The Romans, now they're pygmies. Why? Because that's what's in that area. It doesn't matter. They can be natives of some sort. They can be a corrupt, tyrannical British forces that's, you know, expanding the British Empire. Whatever. You just need something that's suitable. The point is that in your head, they're the Romans, and you're just following the script of the movie. And then you can end up having them in some kind of weird Colosseum type event, right? It's the Colosseum. Now, you're not going to put the Roman Colosseum in the middle of the jungle. Although that'd be a cool game. I won't be against that, right? But what you can do is you can simply set up that I have my tyrants,
the royal the colonel of the Royal British Forces, who's a tyrant, decides that for his amusement, he likes to see the prisoners fight to death. That's your Colosseum. It doesn't have to be made of, you know, granite. It doesn't have to be large arches and all that. It can just be a pit. That's based on Ben-Hur. Doesn't sound a damn thing like Ben-Hur to the players. But you can do that easily. With a number of, and you all have favorite movies. You can do this quickly and easily. You know, Star Wars. Star Wars is perfect to reskin again and again and again because it has all the classic archetypes from many, many different genres, okay? Obi-Wan Kenobi is a wizard. Luke is a farm boy done good, you know? Han Solo is a pirate and a scoundrel, right? And Darth Vader is the Black Knight. I mean, he's literally, he's got a sword and a freaking cape. And you have the Emperor who's the evil king, right? You can reskin that so many ways. You know, let's have it turn into a superhero game, right? You can have that, basically, Galactus is the evil emperor role, and he's made a deal with Dr. Doom, right? Now, I'm using an established genre, but let's say you're playing the Super Game in the Marvel Universe. Dr. Doom's going to play the role of Darth Vader, right? Dr. Strange will give advice to the players, like Obi-Wan, right? Han Solo can be played by Deadpool. If you're familiar with two genres, start mixing and matching, and then run your superheroes game and just go through the freaking Star Wars plot. And nobody will know the better. You know, at the end, when they blow up Dr. Doom's evil lair, that wasn't the Death Star. That was Dr. Doom's evil lair. Right. Now, I did want to make sure that I did some new stuff in this seminar this year. And like I said, every year I wing this. Okay? But, by winging it, I mean I don't prepare what I'm going to say. I think intensely about what I'm going to do. And I thought, why not show you guys what I actually use to run my games with? And one thing I do, rule books from another seminar, ignore those. One thing I do is I frequent dollar stores. It's not because I'm broke. At times I am. But usually I have money. It's because if you wander the aisles of a dollar store and just pick up random crap and put it into a box, you have tons of stuff for your next game. So I visited a local Indiana dollar store. Now, there's a cool factor whenever you bring out a prop. Okay? And it does another thing. It buys you time. Why? Because somebody at the bar on the table says, "Ooh, let me see it." So, this is a bird. It's a little black bird, right? And I'm going to name him Tweety. Better than Pecker. Right? And if I'm running a game, let's say I'm improvising a horror game, right? And I got this box of stuff. Maybe I bring it with me. Maybe it's just in my basement where we usually game. And I just open up that door and I'm like, I need something fitting to the genre. And I see Tweety. Oh, this is great. I can pull this guy out. And I'm running a horror game. And all I have to do is say, PCs are eating dinner, let's say. This bird lands on the windowsill. Makes eye contact with each and every one of you. The maid tries to shoo it away and it's fearless. Now, I have absolutely no idea what the hell that has to do with this story. But I guarantee you, every single player at that table has come up with 10 explanations why they are. And then, if I'm observing my players, I know how to react. If they all are kind of like, stupid bird, all right, Tweety didn't have the effect I needed. All right. But if they start to go, okay, I'm observing it. Does it do, like, strange things, or is it bird-like? You get vague questions. No. And I just say, well, it's doing this that's odd. Why am I saying it's doing this that's odd? Because that's what they're looking for. If I tell them, no, it's a normal bird, one, they won't believe me, and we'll spend 30 minutes describing why it's just a normal bird. But two, now they're going to start feeding me the information for my plot. They're going to start feeding me what should happen next.
Okay, all right. Does it look like it's angry? I have no idea what an angry bird looks like. Right? I've never been attacked by one. I've never been mauled by a bird. I've never been late on a payment to a bird. But I can say, no, it doesn't look angry. It looks like it's observing you, almost like there's intelligence behind its eyes. It's maybe being controlled by something, by that voodoo priestess we met earlier. And at that point, I know exactly why Tweety's in the game. That damn voodoo priestess. And her frickin' bird. What else do I have in here? Yeah, and this is just, I'm serious. This is a damn dollar store and just pick stuff up. I'm going to call him Elmer. So now we got Elmer. Now, it's looks like the devil. So if we're doing a horror game, maybe at one point I can say, and, horror's great. Because you can throw in the simplest thing and it freaks everybody out, right? And I can say, okay, you wake up in your hotel room this morning. You're going through a regular routine. Everything's fine. But that is left on the pillow next to you in your bed. Again, I have no freaking clue. You might just have a really crabby maid. But the point is, because I have a prop, and I look at it, I'm like, yeah, it's kind of scary. But I can also turn around and say that you guys are going down the streets of the fine town of Ballcrest, D&D fantasy type campaign, right? And as you're looking, there's merchants selling various wares. And he says, "Well, this is a token of the Laughing Prince. I'm told it's worth a great and valuable secret. If someone took this to the old abandoned temple, they might be able to unlock the secret treasure room." That's a really flimsy, cheesy plot. I mean, it's stupid. It really is. But what makes it cool is that it's a little bit more tactile of a prop. When I hand this to the players, they're going to kind of get sucked in. It's a little bit more real for them. It's a little bit more tangible. And so they kind of buy into the fact that somehow this merchant has a secret to a vast treasure, and he hasn't gone and gotten it himself, but he's just going to sell them this for like 5 gold, and allow them to get the unlimited wealth of King Azar. Puzzle, right? Haven't even opened it yet. Probably can't with the way it's sealed. Right. Multiple pieces, right? Have it at the end of the encounter. Give the players one of these. Just say, and you find this. I don't know. It's a piece of wood. No, you find it. Next encounter, give them the second piece. And then they're going to be, ooh, they go together. It must be some kind of secret puzzle. Yeah. I wonder why we're finding it, and I wonder what it leads to. And then let them start giving you ideas, right? If they think it takes them to treasure, it does. If they think it takes them to the enemy's stronghold, it does. You're reacting to what the players do. So, this is only an hour-long seminar, and I've already used up half an hour. And I'm a big believer that a seminar is much more fun when the audience actually directs it. Okay? So, I'm going to open the floor to questions. If you don't have questions, don't worry. I can keep on talking. I'm good at that. Yes, sir.
The biggest problem I have is describing areas. I keep end up having the exact same area in each place I go.
Yeah, everything looks like a Walmart parking lot. Do you have a laptop when you go in the game? Okay. I would suggest MBOS is a software firm. Gaming software. And they got some great stuff. I like their stuff a lot. They have something called Inspiration Pad. Alright? You can check out that software, and they have it's free, and it's random generators. And they have, formulas and tables in there. You can come up with your own. You can ask the community if anybody else has come up with a random scene generator. Alright? And that's a great tool. Nothing wrong with having good tools. A lot of improvisation is about having the tools and knowing how to use them. I use random generators. I use software all the time. It makes life a lot easier. But the other thing is that if you're trying to describe the scene, right, most people try to start off with the fantastical. They try to go, well, this is what makes it different. Don't. Start with the norm and then put in one thing that's out of place. Okay? Because the players are going to gloss over things like, you're in the woods. What do you see? Trees. Yeah, they expect that. Right? They just go, well, you know, there's some trees, there's some ferns down below. There's a slight breeze. Try to hit all the senses. That'll definitely help. You want to get, you know, sight, sound, smell. You can even include taste. You go, and there's kind of a mint taste in the air. And that's odd. And that's what you want to get to. You want to set the scene with the normal, so they're just kind of like, yeah, yeah, I get that. And then tell them what's odd, okay? Because they're going to remember that one point, and that means you only have to think of one thing. So hopefully that helps. Is that okay? Any other questions?
For puzzles, would it be good to just throw something out there that you have no idea what the solution is to make them think of?
Absolutely. Yeah, why not? Yeah. Gaming geeks will come up with 101 different ways to solve how to make a spoon. the point with a puzzle is that can it be solved, right? And if it can be solved, does it have to be solved in a particular way? So, I am not a big fan of writing out the solution to any puzzle. Right? I am much happier when I just say, this is how it works. Right? I'm in IT. I know how things work. The reason I know how things work is because I actually have to go and figure out how someone broke it. And that's what you want for players to do. If you just, you know, have an idea of how it works, allow them to break it. Don't have a solution, allow them to break it. If there's a trap and, you know, you decide that, yeah, some of the panels on the floor can be, you know, they're weight sensitive and when you step on them, it triggers the trap. If your PCs go, oh, okay. Well, what we're going to do is we're going to put everything on tangents, floating disk, and just coast on by. Great. You know, they want the solution. They don't want the problem. They want to overcome it. So, yeah, allow them to, you know, if it sounds plausible, go, I'll allow it. You know, because then they feel good about themselves.
Yeah, the trap idea made me think of something. Is there, as soon as a gamer hears that, well, this piece of floor looks a little different than the other, they're immediately jumped to trap. Is there a way you can... Mm-hmm. make it a little more interesting so they're not sure what that is at first?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. The first time that they do that, it's a trap. The second time that they do it, it's a trap. The third time, they tampered with something that would have benefited them. Okay. Then the next time they approach it, they'll be like, wait a minute. We could have gotten that 12-store discount for the if we hadn't destroyed the mighty coupon of Berserk. But, you know, that's another thing. If you're going to improvise, remember what you did and then reference back to it. One, it gives a sense of continuity, right? But two, it makes life a lot easier for you because, you know, your brain's working all the time, right? And you might come up with an idea and it's going to be half-baked, right? Reference back to it and now you have a plot line. It works out really well. Right. Any other questions?
I just like how it
So what happens when you're blind? All right? You have complete total blank. Yeah, you can say that, make something up. But if you're completely blank, just say, you know, guys, I gotta finish the details on this. That's a lie. Just go, you know, guys, I gotta finish the detail on this. How about y'all hit the bathroom and grab another Mountain Dew? Right? Get yourself away from that situation. The reason you're blanking is because you're under pressure. Okay? It's because you got six guys or, you know, six ladies around the table looking at you like, what's next? Well, your brain is trying to do two different things. One, nobody likes to be under pressure. Okay? It's fight or flight. So your brain is, do I fight them? You can't fight with your players. I take that back. You shouldn't fight with your players. Or do I run away? Okay? Well, running away from the table will result in a great gaming story and a lot of game shops for the rest of your life. But you really shouldn't do that either. So that first. Handle that fight or flight response first by giving yourself some distance. You say, I need a moment. There's nothing wrong with the GM asking for a break. When you ask for a break, suggest something for the players to do. Okay? Suggest a snack, suggest, you know, the bathroom, something like that. The next thing you do is you walk away from that table, right? And you don't think about the problem. You think about yourself. You're just like, you know, why am I blanket? What's wrong with me? What am I a little bit tired? Should I be calm again for the night? Am I exhausted? Am I thirsty? Is there something else? Get your mind started on something else, something you can actually solve. You know, get yourself a glass of water. Come back to the table. I guarantee you, you will have the idea by the time you sit down. Right? Because we're great problem solvers. We're just really crappy multitaskers. You know, we've got to take things as they come, and we try to take on too much. Right? And I just guarantee you, you'll have the idea by the time you sit down again. You got a question?
Yeah, suppose you want to integrate more puzzles and or traps. Okay, so there's some part of the group that likes that. Mm-hmm. There's another part of the group that wants to have that likes to fight. Mm-hmm. So you know if you don't have something for them, you're disappointed. You know, there's different players in the group. Mm-hmm. How do you integrate the two sort of, if I can call it, genres, if you will, fighting and the puzzle solving or trap solving, and have it kind of go smoothly without it getting too out of control?
Sure, all right. Well, one, you don't want to be two camps, okay? If you have a division amongst your players where, you know, one half of the group is waiting for the fight, one half of the group is waiting for the traps, you have an issue with the group, all right? Way to solve that, have them fight in a room full of traps. Seriously. It'll be the best game we've had in a long time, because it's like, and then he went to hit the orc, and he stepped on the plate, and it wasn't the coupon this time, it was the fireball. That's one way to handle that. But that's really good GM advice in general. With improv, right, you have another problem, which is that, what's the system? I improvise 4E. How do I improvise 4E? I have a lot of software tools that allow me to improvise 4E. I have the Monster Builder software from D&D Insider. All right. I have various websites I go to with random encounter generators. I have a random map generator that I go to. There's all sorts of things. You have to scour the internet. You have to find the tools that work best. You have to know the system. And then you have to know how to present the system. So, if I have to improvise a trap in 4E, I'm going online. I'm going to the compendium online. And I'm typing in traps. And I'm typing in the level of the players. And I'm picking the first one. Now, they might be in the middle of the woods fighting goblins and orcs and stuff like that. Out in the open, in the field. And the first trap might be something like, activates a stone golem or something like that. Okay? I can't have a statue suddenly appear in the middle of the woods, right? So I just re-skin it. And re-skinning is very simple. It just has to look like it belongs. That stone golem, you come across a tree stump. And it's about 8 feet high. It's very broad. It's gnarled. It looks like it's got a couple of limbs or boughs that were sawed off or something. It looks like someone's kind of pruned this thing. All right? Oh, that's odd. It's the same damn trap. It's just that instead of when it starts, you hear the heavy thud of stone on the floor, you hear the creak of tree limbs as it begins to move. And the roots rip out of the ground and start to come toward you, right? So that's one way to handle traps and when you have to improvise. Now, if I'm running another game, a game we run all the time here at the Gen Con convention, is Fudge, because it's so simple. There, because it's so loose and easy, I just turn around and I'm like, okay, you guys walk into the room, door closes behind you, starts filling up with gas. What do you do? Because I don't have to get really mechanics heavy with that system. I can't do that with 4E. 4E doesn't allow you that kind of flexibility. So know the system and know what tools you need to improvise that system. So I know that kind of went off track, but open up. Let me get to you first, and I'll come back.
Keep you busy for a while.
Sure.
What happened... I often get into situations where I need to prompt the players to do something or get together.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
Any good improv way to do that?
All right. To do something, you know, there's a number of things. One, shiny object. Shiny object works great. You just say, yeah, you know, you're in the dark, mysterious cavern, and you guys have been camping here, and you're not really doing anything. You know what? Down the hallway, you see the slightest flicker of a red light. Yeah, it's just something like that. Just, ooh, it's a shiny object, you know. And they're immediately going to be like, well, it could be a ruby, it could be something's eyes, we're going to do something now, right? Let's say they still don't react to that. They're just like, okay, I'm going to ignore that. Then it attacks. Shiny object shoots an arrow at it. You know, because if you can't bring the fight, the players to the fight, bring the fight to the players. If they're insisting out, we're not going to go out and investigate the Cthulhu-esque setting and the Lovecraftian horror campaign. We're just going to sit in our hotel room. That's fine. Monsters love it when they know where they can find it. You know, the next bellhop's going to have tentacles out of his ass. And you are in for a world of hurt. You called yourselves adventurers, for Christ's sake. You know, so shiny object works really, really well. Getting the group together, right? That's difficult, because when you have all the players deciding that I want to do my own thing, it means that they have too many options. You have to narrow it down. A great way to narrow down options, crisis. Crisis is wonderful. You have real world examples, unfortunately, all too often, right? Katrina, a crisis. Do you really think anybody, you know, kept to their weekend plans when that occurred? No. If your players insist on that they're going to go shopping, and they're not going to actually get on the adventure, and the rest of the party's waiting at the dungeon entrance while the mage is trying to find another spell, the dam broke, the town is flooded, a tidal wave of water is coming towards the magic shelf. What are you going to do? Well, I didn't finish looking through this bookshelf. Fine! You can write as a rap to get your ass out of here. You know, throw in a crisis, because a lot of these problems, there's two sides to the game. There's the mechanical of the game side, where we're trying to, you know, play within the rules and play a game, right? It's overshadowed by the social side of gaming, okay? I don't care what system you run. I don't care what kind of group you have. Gaming is a social activity first and foremost. The reason why we game is because we get to hang out with our friends, eat junk food in my case, you know. That was great. Throwing that in a game. You know, eat junk food with my friends and have a good time. It's kind of the boys' night out for me. You know, I get to hang with my buddies. Right? If that wasn't why I was gaming, if it was just for the game, I can play a ton of games online and have a very rich and interactive experience with the way a lot of video games are going. And that's the biggest threat to our hobby, is the video game industry. It's getting better faster than the RPG industry can compete. I mean, look at it. The advertising alone that's spent on World of Warcraft dwarfs everything at this convention. Every single game. I'm sure of that, right? I don't have the numbers to back it up, but I'm just, you know, I know what they spent on advertising last year, and I know what Wizards of the Coast is worth. But the reason why we're a niche is because we're a community, and because we're friends who gather to do something. And a lot of hobbies are like that. You know, I got buddies who are into classic cars. They'll spend their entire weekend working. It's work, damn it. You got to put a muffler on or something? That's work. You should get paid for that. They do it, and they love it. Do they actually love the task of putting on the muffler? To a certain extent, sure, there's a joy, there's a satisfaction. What they love to do is then go to their car show and show everybody what they did to the Mustang or their Corvette or whatever. You know, that's where you see their eyes brighten up, and they got that big old smile, and they're looking at what their buddies did too. It's the community that draws them in, that makes it truly a hobby. It's that social activity. So whenever you have a problem with your game, ask yourself, is this a game problem or is this a social problem? One's easy to fix. Okay? You change a rule. You make a judgment. You move on. Okay? The other takes communication. Right? And I can go on and on about communication, but I should get back to the point you came here, improvising. So, any other questions? All right. You've asked a lot. I'll get to you eventually. I'll pick you and then you.
How do I deal with when my players want to split the party? Like, one person wants to go off on their own and just leave the party behind.
Okay, yeah. That's a difficult one. It happens. I had it happen to me in a game just yesterday that I was running. They split the party. It was very, very difficult. And the trick I use is that the problem isn't that the party split. The problem is that the party can't communicate while in two different areas at the same time. So try to come up with some kind of device or gimmick in the game that allows them to communicate. Right? The party says we're going to split, and you have an NPC where it's appropriate to do so, say, well, wait a minute, let me cast this spell that will allow you each to talk to each other no matter how far away you are. Right? Now, you just give them the PCs an incredibly powerful tool, and you'll have consequences for that. Right? But the point is that once one party gets into trouble and is having more fun, i.e. combat, the other party is going to be pissed that they weren't there. So you actually arrange it that we can communicate. We know what's going on between each other. We split the party. Oh my God, we just ran into a bunch of orcs. More XP for us. The other party's going to be, wait, we're coming. No. So that's one way is to, you know, they're splitting the party because they believe there's different objectives. The other is that you got a guy or a gal who's just trying to have fun playing a metagame of watch me annoy everyone else at the table.
Yes.
Okay. Right. And that's what I suspected. Right. That's Danny. You have your own Danny. Right. And when that person's having fun and joy at the expense of others, you call a break, you take them aside, and you tell them, look, you know, maybe you're friends, maybe you're not. I don't know. So, look, I know that you're enjoying this. The problem is that your enjoyment is at my expense, and it's my game, and I won't allow you to do that. You either ship up or you get out. Okay? There's some really, I don't know where it began, some stupid idea that, you know, all players are good and everybody deserves a chance. No. There are people in this world who deserve a good kick in the nuts. And I, for one, am more than willing to stand in line to give it to them. Right. When you're getting together for a social activity, if there's someone who's antisocial, boot them. There's nothing wrong with it. The gamer police will not knock down your door and take you in the middle of the night. All right? But far too often, the next thing I hear is, I can't do that. I've been friends with him forever. Well, then stop being friends with him. He's a jerk. You know? I had a co-worker who was unfortunately in an awful situation where her husband was cheating on her. And we all knew about it because, well, she kept talking about it. But she was like, I just can't leave him, though. Well, you know what? Shut up about it. All right? If you're in a bad relationship and you're trying to get out, you have my sympathy, you have my support. If you're going to allow this to go on and on and on, you like being the victim. I don't have time for you. Okay? And it's kind of the same thing with the problem player. They love that negative attention. They're getting kind of a high off of it. Take away their face. Kick them out. No problem with it. There will be consequences. You will be a jerk. You won't get their Christmas cards anymore. You'll be happier. You only live on this world for about 74 years on average. Make every one of them count. Don't hang out with stupid people. another question for Lauren.
Yeah, I run a horror mystery game, and a lot of the times my players out of thin air will figure out the end, not how to get to the end, but the end.
Sure. Nothing wrong with that. They reach the end. They solve the puzzle. Everything's totally, totally cool. It's great. Leave one odd item out of place. Just
throw in some, throw a black glove on the dresser and make sure they all see it. The point is that you have an ending. You have a solution that they can get to, right? And there's nothing wrong with that. But if you're trying to provoke that sense of suspense, that idea that there's more to discover, give them more to discover. And it doesn't have to make sense at that time. You know, give them a cliffhanger. Yeah. And then you have time to prep, and they're going to do it again. Players are great at figuring out stuff that we think is so complex. Another thing to do, though, is that a lot of players are good at solving mysteries because they're good at thinking outside the box, right? Put it squarely in the box. Make it the simplest damn explanation. Not only did the butler do it, he's caught on videotape. And let their imaginations go wild. Because if they had a really complex, difficult mystery the first time, they'll never suspect that the next one's going to be a Scooby-Doo episode. Right? And play with them on that. You know? I think it was the banker. You. Because, you know, the banker has been seen around the ground sneaking about. Red herring. The banker's been shagging the maid. Give them a bunch of little mini red herrings. Really simple mystery to solve. Lots of juicy red herrings. Play it up. It should work out pretty well. So I hope that helps.
Thanks.
All right. Any other questions? Yeah, back to you.
One thing I have a lot of trouble coming up with, especially in like 4th edition, is terrain things for combat, like actual environmental hazards, something they can use.
You have to know the rules, first of all. Right? You have to understand how difficult terrain works in something like 4th, or whatever game system you're running. You have to understand the rules before you start improvising. Okay? Just to keep this on track with improvising, the cast of Saturday Night Live is able to put a show together in a week, not because they all showed up and they were actors. It's because they all went to improv school and learned the rules of improvisation, right? And they learned that there are certain things that you can do on TV and there are certain things that you can do on stage, and they don't break those rules, right? You have to know the rules of the game system first and foremost. The other thing is that you have to understand why you think difficult terrain is needed in this encounter, okay? Are you trying to heighten the tension? Are you trying to give yourself a tactical advantage for the big bad evil guy? All of these are fine, but understand why you're throwing in difficult terrain. Maybe it's just because you want a more realistic setting. Hey, you guys are fighting amongst the mountaintops. It shouldn't be that easy to move. That's difficult terrain where you're going to just kind of scribble out the path and be like, okay, everything within this area is difficult terrain. It applies to both monsters and PCs, right? Let's say you want to make it more challenging, right? At that point, you decide what's going to give my monster the more tactical advantage, right? Once you start thinking about that, it's pretty easy to come up with different terrain. Because you put the monster here, the terrain that's an obstacle here, and then you put the PCs up here. And, oh yeah, there's more monsters. So really understand why you're trying to throw it in. And then when it comes time to improvise this, usually what I do is I start drawing something out. I put the monsters on the board where I think they belong. And I say to the PCs, put yourselves where you want. They put their figures on the board. And I'll tell them, no, you're not right next to me. Move your ass back. Because there's always one guy who's like, I'm right here, man. I'm next to everybody. And then I pull out a really big miniature and put that behind his. He likes dwarves. You start doing that. Take whatever you're using as your implement to, whether it be a battle man, dry erase, whatever. And just start scribbling stuff. Make circles, stuff like that. Then sit back and have the players go, what's that? Okay. And at that point, you can say, well, that's difficult terrain, or that's impassable terrain. Or you can say, oh, yeah, that's a bunch of kegs. What do the kegs say on? XXX. Okay. They're going to mess with that stuff. You put TNT on the side of them, because these will definitely But the point is that if you're trying to improvise terrain,
you don't have to be Picasso to make something interesting on the map. You just start scribbling little simple shapes. Squares, triangles, circles. That's all you need to know how to make. And the PDCs ask, what's that? Come up with something. You know? And if it's nothing, you know, just say, yeah, it's just boulder in the middle of the field. Why is it triangle? I don't know, it's carved. It looks like, you know, some druids used to live here. You know? And then maybe in the middle of the game, if one steps on it, you can just, if you're, you know, quick-witted and you're just trying to think, man, I don't know what that triangle thing is. Oh, you stepped on it? Well, you just got a plus one to your AC. Ah, I knew there was something about that truck. And you're nodding your head going, oh yeah. So, I'll take one more question and then I got to get to my next seminar. So, anybody? Sir?
Okay, what about high level characters who have, with equipment or the magic or whatever, that pretty much can do whatever? And you've got a, you know, a fairly decent storyline, and it's just, you know, you got to improvise with something that sort of makes it challenging for them. It's not trying to nerf them, because that's what they're playing there. They want to get new stuff.
Yeah.
But you want it. But it's the issue of, it's not power creep, but it's kind of power creep. How do you keep the keep it kind of flavorful and particularly on the fly?
Yeah. Okay. Some games have to have characters retired after a while, right? And that's something we handle after the game. The PCs are starting to get too powerful, and it's just no longer fun. Talk to your group and say, hey, guys, seriously, there's a point where this becomes ridiculous. But...
a little below that.
All right. Great thing to do is that you're probably at a point, I'm guessing here, you're probably at a point where you're not able to find something that's quite appropriate for their level, that's a challenge for them. There's plenty of stuff beneath them, level-wise and challenge-wise, and there's probably still stuff above them, level-wise and challenge-wise.
And if you do the other one, you wind up killing too easy.
No, not exactly.
Okay.
Orcus comes to town. He gets into a fight with the PCs. He whoops their ass. Orcus' objective is not to take out the PCs. He's at the temple to grab one artifact. And all the PCs have to do is stop him from getting that artifact, right? Now, they don't know why Orcus showed up. Because I'm serious. Just had Orcus show up. It's an impression that no, you know, player wants to have, but it does, right? And his objective is not to kill the party. They're pleased to him. He doesn't care about it. He grabs the artifact, he disappears. Right? Instantaneous. Encounter's over. Orcus won. You know? Just say, no, you're not getting any XP for that. He didn't beat him. He got his objective. He may not have killed you because you're insignificant. And when you tell a PC that they're insignificant,
ooh, that's salt on the wound.
Yep. And I guarantee you, now they're going to start, you know, gearing the game up to, we got to beat Orcus, and you have something to work with. The other end of the spectrum is, kobolds? Anybody can beat kobolds. Kobolds are easy. Kobolds are the most devious little bastards in the world. Right? One of my favorite drafts ever, and I did this with a level 10 party. Okay, level 10 should be able to take out kobolds like nobody's business, right? The kobolds had a little like a plank that they ran into their dwelling with, right? And it was a pressure-sensitive plate, right? Kobold only weighs so much, and an adventurer weighs significantly more, right? Halfling runs across, no problem. Dwarf runs across, and the fire ant colony falls down. Now, it couldn't have killed him, right? But just the wisecracks about ants and beers for the next was worth it. You don't have to have something that the players can count on and destroy. You have to have something that aggravates them and annoys them, right? You have to give them other types of challenges. If they can win every fight, that's fine. What are they going to do when the kingdom decides to, you know, repossess the land that the orphanage is on, that they swear to protect? You know? Give them other types of challenges like that. You know? Don't let them use their strengths. Attack their weaknesses. And then have Orcus show up. I got to get to another seminar. You were all great. Thank you.